The teenager accused of the Parsons Green tube attack pleads not guilty to using the infamous TATP compound. The Manchester bombing inquests are further pushed back until the summer, and MI5 investigates itself with a predictable outcome. All this and more on today's Wide Shut webcast.
It's the Wide Shut webcast.
Welcome along to the Wide Shut webcast. I'm your host, Keelan Balderson. And today I wanted to give everyone an update and an overview, really, of the whole Manchester bombing and Parsons Green cases. As many of you will know, I've been giving my take on this since Manchester went down, really, last May, exploring the unanswered questions about what happened, as well as the inconsistent and often confusing accounts that have come out through the media and the narrative put out by the investigators themselves. Obviously, we have the gist of the story. Salman Abedi blew up the Manchester Arena. This many people died. But when you actually dig down into the detail, everything from this guy's background to the type of device that he was supposed to have used, to how it was built and how he got trained in doing that, to where his body was in the arena in relation to the blast and all that kind of thing, it all gets a little bit murky, and no media outlet, even in the alternative media, seem to be covering this with any real consistency. Obviously, the mainstream now have moved on to the human interest side of the story. You know, they're covering the remembrance concert, the individual stories of the people, which is fine, but we also need to dig in and take a look at our intelligence services and really try to understand how this went down, the context that it went down, how it's being used for different agendas. And not many people have really been doing that. All we've really had from the so-called alternative media, whatever that means at this point, I don't know. But you get the YouTube videos. I mean, I was watching a documentary last weekend. I had high hopes. I went into it with a positive mind. Maybe somebody has done some good work on this. And it was the same old nonsense. Crisis actors. Trying to link it with everything under the sun, including Sandy Hook. Like, just bullshit. So, I think there's definitely a need to look at this case, as well as Parsons Green, with a rational eye, without being blind to the dubious actions of the security state, of course, without being blind to the very real problems with the official stories, but also without being a cliched conspiracy nut who just wants to scream that it's all fake. There's a middle ground there that deserves our time. I think it's that middle ground where truth usually lies in any kind of situation. Of course, there was some hope that a lot of the Manchester stuff would be cleared up by the inquests, and that could still be the case, but unfortunately those inquests won't be taking place now until the summer. We had the openings of the inquests, the inquest into the deceased victims, and there's a separate one for Abedi himself. They opened last year, then they got pushed back to early 2018, and now it's all been pushed back until they suspect sometime in the summer, but really there's no date set on that. And the only explanation being given is that investigators are still trying to piece everything together, because of course we have the brother over in Libya. So let's go to Parsons Green first. That was the attack on the morning of September 15th, when an eastbound District Line train stopped at the Parsons Green Overground tube station, and a device went off that only really injured people superficially and didn't really leave any damage to the carriage itself. This wasn't 7-7, this wasn't Madrid. This was a botched or a deliberately weak attack. Fortunately, nobody died. But of course, that fact has mobilized the annoying Everything is Fake brigade, and for a while there, Facebook and YouTube were full of videos and memes about a lady wearing a clean coat, which meant that she was an actor, which meant the whole thing was a hoax. No, that's not how this works. Aside from the fact that if she was an actor, she could have just as easily worn a dirty coat and covered herself in fake blood, the story has never been that this was a fatal attack. So what's the problem with people not having fatal injuries and being relatively unscathed? what exactly have you uncovered other than people in an attack that wasn't very powerful look like they've been in an attack that wasn't very powerful? But anyway, I don't want to get down that road. On Friday, Ahmed Hassan Ali, the 18-year-old charged with carrying out this incident, pled not guilty, which means we will have a full jury trial, and that will begin on March 5th. And hopefully, we now do get to see some of that evidence from the prosecution, see if it stands up to scrutiny, see if a jury of his peers feel that it stands up to scrutiny, and hopefully get a better understanding of what went on. And I'm particularly interested with this because he's explicitly charged with using the chemical compound TATP, triacetone triperoxide. And he's alleged to have used this to, quote, cause an explosion that was likely to endanger life. So he's charged with attempted murder and basically using an explosive. Quite how they'll frame it in the courtroom, though, is going to be the interesting part, because TATP can be used as part of the detonation. So it can be sort of like the, I don't know the exact terminology, but it can be the primer that sets off the other explosive. So it's like the starting part of the device. Or it can be used as the main bulk of the explosive as well, depending on how you've made the device. And if they're alleging that the primary compound was TATP, not just the detonation bit, then it seems to go against the vast body of eyewitness accounts that talk about a fireball going through the carriage. And there are burns and such associated with that event.
There was a bang, it wasn't massively loud, but then a scream, and then I looked down the corridor and there was a big flash of light coming down.
Then this fireball above my head has come, singed all my hair. I've got sort of burn marks to the top of my head.
I just saw quite a lot of fire coming towards us. We really felt the heat of it. It's one of your worst fears, to see an explosion in a tube train.
The reason that might be problematic is because TATP on its own is not what they call exothermic, which means it doesn't react in a fiery explosion. It doesn't produce the kind of heat that you would expect in an explosion. It doesn't produce the flames. Anyone can go watch TATP experiments online. I don't know if that's wise now, I'm not sure, but they are there. But the best way to describe it is that it's an energetic force that rips through things and it leaves white smoke, but that's about all the visual you'll get. There's no fireballs, unless of course other explosives are used in conjunction with it, or there's other flammable material or whatever as part of the device. And sure, there absolutely could have been. Met Police Chief Cressida Dick seems to hint at that in her LBC interview, and I'll play that now.
But that was a very, very dangerous bomb. It partially detonated, it had a large quantity of explosive, and it was packed with shrapnel. So it could have been so much worse, indeed, as you said.
We also have Prosecutor Lee Ingham saying that, quote, the device did not function as intended. It did not function the TATP, probably due to inaccurate construction. That's kind of flipped it around, and that suggests that TATP was the main explosive in the bucket, and something else was the primer, the detonation part of the device, and maybe it's just that that went off. So we wonder what chemical or what the makeup was of that, and why they're not choosing to focus on that, considering that is presumably what actually caused the damage that was caused, this superficial fireball that didn't really damage the carriage and burned a few people, but didn't really do anything too serious, fortunately. But in terms of the charge and in terms of what the prosecution have to prove, TATP is the chemical that they've, for whatever reason, chosen to single out. So yeah, I'm very interested to see what the evidence is and how they present it in court in terms of the full makeup of this bucket bomb in a little bag. Was the, quote, TATP actually just inert and, you know, never really got to the point of being anything too dangerous?
You know, was it TATP or was it something kind of resembled it but wasn't mixed properly? Just a bucket of sludge? As we saw with 7-7, and I've gone over this a billion times, so please go back and overview all my 7-7 stuff. There's a bit of history there in a lot of attacks of the authorities claiming that TATP was used or similar types of substances when it wasn't actually there, or there's no evidence for it, or the substances they have found don't actually go off and aren't actually, you know, they're inert when forensics or explosives experts take it to the side and try and test it. TATP has become sort of part of the terrorism folklore, but isn't really the reality of the situation. You know, they'll say, oh, like TATP that was used on 7-7, but that was never proven. And now they're saying, like was used in Manchester, even though we've not even had the inquest or any proof that that was used in Manchester, and they'd say it was used over here. And you've got this whole body of claims, but the evidence was never actually there. And this is just general knowledge, but it's worth going to an article and giving you the link in the show notes just so you can verify what I'm saying. But in the Washington Post, they quote an army explosives expert where he says the enemy in Iraq and Afghanistan don't use TATP in those conflicts because it's too volatile. You know, it can just blow up while you're transporting it around or while you're making it. It's dangerous, it's volatile. But he says, quote, however, it has become a staple for terrorists in Europe because of the easy accessibility of the chemicals required to make it. Is that a contradiction? That doesn't really explain why they would use it, because it doesn't negate the fact that it's still incredibly volatile and still will blow up on you. The reason they wouldn't be using it in Iraq and Afghanistan is the same reason why you wouldn't be using it anywhere in the world under any context. So I think there is a problem there, that we have these so-called young amateur bomb makers who learn to make their devices at home via YouTube, and they're lugging around these ingredients and casually mixing it together in their homes and flats, but it's extremely volatile and none of them have blown themselves up. It's never gone wrong yet. We've never had a random flat blow up. We've never had someone transporting a device blow up. You know, someone, a terrorist blowing up on the way to the scene or whatever. So where do we take that logically? We have a couple of options. These alleged terrorists aren't using TATP because it's too volatile, or because somebody else or something else, like somebody else using something else, is doing this, or they're trying to use TATP, but because it's actually pretty hard to make, they don't ever get it to the point of being volatile, because like Parsons Green, it was a dud. The thing that's correct in that army officer's, army explosives expert statement, is that yes, it does seem relatively easy to get hold of the ingredients for TATP. So if we want to get hypothetical, if we want to do some speculating, if you were a group framing somebody for a bombing, if you were running a black op, you would use, or at least claim that a substance was used that could be relatively easy to get hold of. You see what I'm saying? You wouldn't use C4 or claim that C4 was used in a false flag attack and then say a random teenager did it, because a random teenager doesn't have access to C4. They can get hold of peroxide, they can get hold of black pepper and all this other stuff that you can use to get a TATP-like compound made. They can mix some sludge together that can tacitly be called an explosive if investigators find it. Even if it doesn't go off, you know, even if it's inert and never really got completed properly. Whether the black op team blows the train up with something else, you know, all that depends on their aim. You know, we can go off down that road. But the presence of homemade explosives somewhere, whether they work or don't, be it on a train or in a flat somewhere else, allows that narrative of an amateur who could easily get hold of the ingredients, who was on YouTube, to be crafted. And you can take that in all sorts of different directions. This is just me speculating. And I'm not opposed to speculating about false flag terror. But that's the kind of detail I'm interested in, rather than, you know, making memes and playing spot the crisis actor and all that nonsense. If we're going to speculate, let's at least bring something to the table. And going by what I just said, Parsons Green does look like a botched attack by a dumb teenager who perhaps managed to get a crude TATP mixture together but couldn't really get it to do anything. That's much more believable to me than the story we've been presented regarding Manchester, that Salman Abedi managed to teach himself how to make this sophisticated bomb just by watching a YouTube video, this fully working device, and he managed to do this with seemingly no test bombs first, and despite casually buying almonds and a tin of tuna from Tesco, he decided to kill himself in a suicide bombing a couple of hours after doing that. A lot of those gaps in logic aren't there with the Parsons Green story. And that doesn't mean I buy the official story, I'm just saying it seems more believable on the face of it. It still needs to be proven. We still need to see the evidence of TATP, we still need to see the background of this guy and see what's presented in court. But there are some stark contrasts between the two events. And you can interpret that in many different ways, depending on how you're looking at it. You know, maybe this kid from Iraq, whose parents were killed during the Western invasion, as is claimed, who says he was tortured himself and blamed the UK for that, maybe he did have his grievances, maybe he did bumble along and make a device, and this was the result. A black operation in that context might just have required the security services or whoever's running it to not pass on some information, to look the other way. The concept of lie hop, let it happen on purpose. Whereas maybe Manchester was something else. It's certainly more complex at this stage, where we have the Abedi family ties to Libya and MI6 and all that kind of stuff that we've gone through quite a few times now. And that's another one of my issues with the online conspiracy community. They try to apply a one-size-fits-all template to false flag terrorism. Oh, they're all crisis actor hoaxes. Every single one of them. Or every single event has to have had a training drill, even when there isn't any evidence that there was one. That's just what we've decided to latch onto. Why would everything be the same? That's not how the world works. We live in a complex world. There are all sorts of variables. Black operations are going to play out in different ways depending on what's available at the time, you know, who they see as a patsy, what their informants and assets are doing, you know, what their actual end goal is. Everything isn't the same. And I do find it interesting that after such a spectacular attack at Manchester, we have this Parsons Green dud, frankly. You know, that didn't really do anything, but that took place at an overground station, not in the confines of the underground, where the damage and fallout would have been much worse. Right out in the open, where the emergency services could get there right away. Right out in the open, where the media could get there. Whoever did this, was the intention to kill as many people as possible, or was it just to scare? Was it never really meant to go off in the first place? Was this more of a psyop? A little added extra to the terror that we'd already experienced those few months before? Who knows, but let's get into something a bit more tangible before we go off on one. As we've seen with pretty much all modern Islamic terror attacks, the alleged culprits are always known to the security services to some degree. So much so that MI5 chief Andrew Parker now admits it to the media.
The likelihood is that when an attack happens, it may be done by somebody that we know or have known at some point in the past.
The BBC last year coined the term, this new word, known wolf.
Unfortunately, it would not be surprising. This concept of a lone wolf now would more accurately be described as a known wolf.
Prior knowledge is now part of the mainstream dialogue, when before it was something you had to sort of pick out. And there is this one clip from ITV News regarding the Parsons Green attack, where this young lad claims that police had visited the foster home of Ahmed Hassan prior to the attack, and that he was known to them. So let's take a listen to that.
Neighbours now claim police were regularly visiting the property in the weeks before the attack.
Police turned up, non-uniformed, undercover car, and this time they actually went in and spoke to Penny and Ron, which made me question Saturday night if this was under, if the house was under surveillance, and if it was, why couldn't it have been done sooner? You know, could they not search the house sooner? Could they not have raised more questions?
So, if this is true, it does indeed raise the question, what did the police know? What did they have on this guy? What did they suspect? And what was done with that information in terms of it being passed on to the security services? Who had the information? If the security services, if MI5 did have the information, what did they do with it? It's also possible that this young neighbour is talking bollocks. I mean, think about it for a minute. If some police officers turn up in plain clothes in an unmarked vehicle, how do you know the police officers? You know, so it's an interesting piece of information that we can put aside and hopefully work out at a later date, but let's not get stuck on it, because unless this guy elaborates, then we can't know for sure. But of course, with Salman Abedi, there's a pretty long established line of prior intelligence, traced all the way back to the community where he lived in Manchester, which was full of dissidents from Libya who have ties to MI6 as part of this proxy war against Gaddafi. And then reports of locals shopping him to the prevent strategy, him flying back and forth, or at least travelling back and forth to Libya under the context of control orders being lifted in 2011. You have him visiting a convicted terrorist in prison. You know, there's a whole long list of things that prove there was a degree, a very strong degree of prior intelligence, including their official report, which we'll get to later. But with Ahmed Hassan, there really isn't a lot about him, other than that he's an Iraqi and that he claims that his parents were killed in Iraq and he was tortured in Iraq. Is this the first case of actual blowback in the literal sense of the word? Anyway, Hassan's trial begins on March 5th, so not long before we can dig a bit more into that case. I want to now jump back over to Manchester. There isn't much news since the last full podcast I did, but the reason being given for the inquests being held off is that they're still trying to get Salman's younger brother Hashim extradited from Libya. It's not even clear if they've actually spoken to him yet, and if not, what the problem is. But they are now officially treating him as a suspect as part of this case, which means the inquest can't take place while there's an ongoing investigation, because in theory they could bring Hashim to trial for the attack. What I still find interesting about this is that originally investigators were so sure that Salman acted alone. That's what they told the media. Detective Chief Superintendent Russ Jackson made a statement way back in May at the time that inquiries show Abedi himself made most of the purchases of the core bomb components, and what is becoming apparent is that many of his movements and actions have been carried out alone. Everyone they actually rounded up were released without charge, and their only focus was on him. Then it comes out in Libya that Hashim claims he was the one that bought the bomb parts. You can't have it both ways. Either investigators have evidence that Salman bought most of the bomb parts, you know, CCTV of him walking into the shops, getting all this stuff, internet data, buying it from Amazon or whatever, and in which case they have proof that Hashim is lying. Or they never had that evidence that Salman bought the bomb parts and they don't know where they came from, in which case, why did they tell the media that they did? And if that's how flippantly they treat the investigation, then what else is just hearsay? What else is just nonsense? It came out this past week that, shock horror, YouTube bomb-making video watched by Manchester killer Salman Abedi before Arena Blast is still online. Again, playing into this narrative that he acted alone and he learnt how to make the bomb by himself on the internet. A YouTube bomb-making tutorial viewed by the Manchester Arena suicide maniac is still online, a US probe has heard. Senator John Thune said, according to the Counter-Extremism Project, One single bomb-making video used to instruct the Manchester suicide bomber has been uploaded to YouTube and removed 11 times, but continues to resurface as recently as this month. Well, this is all very interesting, apart from the fact that nobody has ever presented any evidence that Salman actually did view this video. It's just come out in the wash and been accepted as fact. We haven't had the inquest, and this might not even come up in the inquest. We haven't seen his browser data, they've not claimed that they've actually got his browser data. It's not even clear where this is coming from. It's sort of filtered out through this weird quango called Quilliam, who just came out and stated it as fact. And they're obviously getting their information, if it has any validity at all, from the security services. But this is far from a closed case. And even if he did view this kind of material, that doesn't mean that was the only way he was trained. I find it very difficult to believe that this young guy who dropped out of college could learn how and go on to actually build this sophisticated bomb that had a remote detonator, that did all this damage, that he could do all this just by watching this YouTube video. Where was his first and second attempts? Where are the duds? Where are the experiments? It's not a chocolate cake. Even chocolate cakes are hard to make the first time. Have you ever cooked a new meal for the first time? What it is, though, is a very convenient explanation that steers the investigation away from all of this background information. It steers the investigation away from Libya, from a wider network, from the government's policies that allowed people to travel freely to Libya to become extremists, that steers people away from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who the Abadi father, at least, was a member of, who were one of these proxy armies for MI6 back in the 90s. I'd suggest that there's a lot of things there that the state would rather be lost down the memory hole, and they're trying to simplify the case and make it seem like Salman did this all in a vacuum by himself, so they don't have to open that Pandora's box. There's no wider context, it's just YouTube, we need to ban this video. You know, please ignore 30 years of dodgy foreign policy sponsoring Islamic extremists all over the world. It's YouTube that's the problem. Please ignore that we've had virtually every terrorist that has attacked Britain already on file, already under surveillance before they carried out the attacks. The real people we need to target are Amazon, because they sell electronic switches and ball bearings. You know, this could be the reason it's taking so long for them to extradite Hashim. Maybe it's not because they're having trouble doing that, but they're not sure how to handle the situation when he gets here. Because he might force it to be a much wider investigation. If he goes to trial, a lot has to then come out. Or it could be that he's not really involved at all, and they're trying to figure out a way to actually pin the case on him, I don't know. But there is potentially a lot there that MI5 and the police don't want the public to know about. And I don't know if anyone saw this in the news, but they have tried to sort of close that Pandora's box. If you remember, shortly after Manchester, there were several internal reviews launched to discover whether the agency could have prevented, you know, MI5 could have prevented the attack, to see what they knew about Salman Abadi and to see if they had any culpability. Because there were those prior warnings from the United States, people had reported him locally, and of course the whole Libyan thing, as we've just talked about. And most of us, I think, expected this internal inquiry to just disappear. If they're investigating themselves, they're not going to actually find any wrongdoing, are they? They're probably not even going to bother doing the inquiry. They'll just say that they've done it. But to my shock, and to a lot of people's shock, they have actually completed this review. They did actually do something. And it did, in fact, quote, involve an independent reviewer, a QC, a Queen's Counsel, and he actually concluded that yes, the Manchester terror bombing could have been prevented. At least that's how the media have put it in the headlines. So what's going on here? Has everything been spilled? Well, actually, this is quite a clever piece of propaganda, because on the face of it, it looks like they're being quite open and honest about their failings, but when you read between the lines, it's actually just more of the same. You know, oops, we nearly stopped him, but we'll definitely do better next time. Just give us some more money and resources and we'll get them next time. And I'm going to pull this from The Telegraph, But it's pretty much the same coverage anywhere. And I've also got the link to the raw document, which has all the findings in. But MI5 had planned to discuss the threat posed by the Manchester suicide bomber just 9 days after he launched his attack, an official report has revealed. The review by David Anderson QC found that the bombing, which killed 22 people, could have been averted had the cards fallen differently. Salman Abedi had been highlighted for discussion at an MI5 meeting due to take place on May 31st, but he detonated his explosives at the Manchester Arena 9 days earlier. Oh, they just missed him. Internal reviews into the police and MI5's handling of the four terrorist attacks to strike Britain this year said MI5 had on two separate occasions received intelligence on Abedi, whose significance was not fully appreciated at the time. So in the United States, as someone's planning an attack, they don't view it as significant. Yeah, right. The report by David Anderson QC, a former terrorism law reviewer asked by the Home Secretary to audit internal MI5 and police reviews, said, in retrospect, the intelligence can be seen to have been highly relevant to the planned attack. His 61-page report concluded it was conceivable that the Manchester attack, in particular, might have been averted had the cards fallen differently. Well, that's what they said about 7-7. That's what they always say. They failed to connect the dots. They had the information, but they didn't use it. They didn't put two and two together. They forgot. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. You know, at some point, is that not criminal negligence? You know, to just say, oops, we failed. They just have free rein to say that. Think about it. If they can just say, we're sorry, we failed, then they can do absolutely anything. There has to be some further, deeper scrutiny. Else every single time, they just have plausible deniability. And of course, when you look at this document, it's just a review of MI5's own internal reviews. So it's still very much MI5 investigating itself, just with someone else giving it a little read over afterwards and then paraphrasing them and signing off on it. David Anderson QC doesn't actually do any investigating himself. He's just giving the public the Cliff Notes version. And you know how we know that this review is a load of bollocks? Because it doesn't mention the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. It doesn't mention their history with MI6 and this hub in Manchester. It doesn't mention anything about the situation with Gaddafi, control orders being lifted, proxy fighters going over there at the behest of the British state, all that relevant backstory, and a lot of the other pieces of prior intelligence that's already out there in the media, things we've already talked about. What we have here, folks, is a classic limited hangout. It gives the appearance to the general public that MI5 have been dragged across the coals, but the true reality is nothing has been revealed at all. And you may be wondering, or you probably won't be, because they haven't done anything in years really, where are the Intelligence and Security Committee, Parliament's dedicated committee that's supposed to scrutinise MI5? That's pretty much the only way they can do it. Where are they? Why aren't they leading this review? Why haven't they investigated? And I'd actually completely forgotten about the ISC. I haven't really heard much about them since when I was doing my 7-7 stuff. But somebody at the university I go to called Andrew Defty, he runs a blog called Watching the Watchers, and you can find that at watchingthewatchers.blogs.lincoln.ac.uk. You'll find the link in the show notes. And he specifically covers this process. So his blog is about how Parliament hold the intelligence and security agencies to account. And it just so happens that the ISC was basically shut down in April before the election. And just before the Manchester attack, in fact. How's that for timing? And through all the attacks last year, the committee was dormant. They hadn't appointed the new members yet. So they were in no position to actually do the job that they're supposed to do. And now that the committee has been appointed, well, there's no point in them scrutinising this thing all over again because David Anderson's already done it. Like, he said He even said that if the car does fallen differently, this could have been prevented. He dragged them across the coals. There's no need for us to do this now. And that's pretty much where we are. They're completely unaccountable. And that's why this non-stop push for more funding and more resources is particularly concerning. Why would you throw money at something if you don't know where it's going and you can't scrutinize the people that get the money? It's just common sense. You don't do that. And look, the budget for these agencies has gone up consistently since 7/7. It's always going up. Don't buy into this nonsense that there's been cuts. Not to this, there hasn't been. It's been going up and up and up. Maybe the rate at which it's increasing has been decreased, but they're still getting billions. I dug back through, and in 2013 and 2014, they got 2.48 billion. And then in 2015, that was bumped up by an extra 1.5 billion. And according to the most recent quotes from the Home Office, between 2015 and 2020, they will have been given 15.1 billion. Do they need more money and resources? Or is it simply the way they do things not working? And not only do they get all that money, they don't have to account for it. Which agency gets what, you know, MI5, MI6, GCHQ, the taxpayer doesn't know how it's broken down. MPs don't know how it's broken down. They just get to say counter-terrorism. And all that's without mentioning the so-called Conflict Stability and Security Fund. There's a bit of controversy over this too. This is a fund of over £1 billion every year. So every year a new £1 billion is issued. And this pot of money is used for the covert operations in places like Syria and Libya. Often under the guise of, you know, aid. But it's the Conflict Stability and Security Fund. And you know, it's all these countries where we just happen to be supporting Islamic extremists. And last year, there was an inquiry, and it came out that there was no strategy for this funding. Or at least, there was no strategy they were willing to tell MPs about, i.e., they're not telling you how it's used. They're hiding it under the guise of national security. So we don't know exactly which groups are getting the money. And Amber Rudd refused to tell MPs. She did let slip that the White Helmets were getting some of it. But let's not be naive here. Even if it wasn't the intention, as we've seen in the United States, if money's going over there to these places, these war-torn places like Syria and Libya, it's falling into the hands of terrorists, the kind of terrorists that might want to attack this country. So point one, they're getting billions. Point two, in every major terror event that has taken place in this country, the alleged culprits have been known in some way to the authorities. They've been surveilled. They've been bugged for engaging in terror-related activity. They've been referred by people they know because they seem like they've become radicalized. Why are we so ready to throw money at agencies that already have billions and are unaccountable with those billions, that already know who these people are, and in fact are doing some very shady things at the same time? And I always go back to the infamous 7/7 photo of alleged bombers Khan and Tanweer, because it's just a pure example of how oops almost seems like, we're doing this deliberately. There was this photo, and you can see it, and it's in my videos, and I've talked about it, and you can see it online. This photo was cropped and photocopied of these alleged bombers so badly that an informant wasn't able to identify it. Or he could say that he couldn't identify it, you know, plausible deniability. And then they get to say, well, in hindsight, you know, we just kind of messed up. The information wasn't shared properly. The systems weren't linked properly. Dave doesn't know how to work a photocopier. So give us another £1 billion and we'll do better next time. No, I don't trust you. The veil needs to be lifted. We need proper independent scrutiny of these agencies. They need to be completely overhauled. And interestingly, one of the people calling for more funding, at least on the police side of things, is a woman called Cressida Dick, who we heard in a clip earlier, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police.
But I understand people are worried and they are asking questions. And one of those questions is, do we have sufficient police and do we have sufficient armed officers? And obviously that's something that we need to look at in the coming weeks.
You've been in the job.
Absolutely. So there's a whole load of things to review. We are have been investing in armed policing. We have superbly trained, highly capable, highly mobile officers. Any leader is going, of course, to ask for more resources. I would love to have more resources. I absolutely would. And I will be working with the mayor and whoever is in government next to seek, of course, more resources. And more people would be great.
For those that don't know, Cressida Dick was actually the person that led the operation that killed John Charles de Menezes, the innocent Brazilian guy who, after 7-7, basically just a random member of the public, was catching the tube, and the police shot him a ridiculous number of times in the head in an execution as he just got on to one of the carriages. And then they lied about it. They said things like he jumped the ticket barrier when that wasn't the case. They tried to say that he was wearing really bulky gear, which looked like he was carrying bombs and stuff, but actually he wasn't. And they just tried to dress it up like he was this suspected Islamic suicide bomber that they were supposedly surveilling, and trying to make out that he was fleeing from them when it just wasn't the case. And ultimately, the inquest into that was an open verdict. He was an innocent guy, that's not in dispute. But the verdict was open, which means obviously no one's going to be held to account for that. It should have been an unlawful killing. What else do you call an innocent man being executed on the tube if it's not an unlawful killing? And the person who led that operation deserves to be promoted and appointed the head of the Metropolitan Police? And she wants the same kind of armed police roaming the streets that carried out that operation? If you're Menezes' family, you're going to take that as a sick joke. And even just on a practical level, this idea that we need more police on the streets following these incidents. You can only stop an attack if there's prior intelligence, which there always is, but they're not using it. But a ramped up police presence doesn't really do anything. If they don't know something's going to happen, then what? Unless, of course, you go to the extreme measure of stopping and searching everyone at gunpoint who has a little shopping bag, which of course is not the world that any of us want to live in. Then of course you have the old chestnut, well, it makes the public feel safer. Not me, it doesn't make me feel safer. I know about John Charles de Menezes, other people may have forgotten, but I haven't. The only funding gap that I see, which I can get behind, is the emergency services, the fire, the ambulance services and all that. But anyway, that's pretty much where we are with all this now. Sorry that I haven't wrapped this up in a neat little bow, that I haven't blamed crisis actors or said that the Mossad did it or whatever, but the real world is very complex and confusing, and you know, it doesn't always come with a clear conclusion. But I hope that we've explored some of the avenues here, and we will continue to revisit it as more information comes out, as the inquests happen, as trials happen, and so on and so forth. Definitely check out the terrorism section of wideshut.co.uk. Also, go back and listen to the previous podcasts if you haven't got into this yet. My chats with Pierce Redman on Porkins Policy Radio, going over a lot of this stuff. But that's it for now. I'll catch you next time.